This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With all the hullabaloo in Washington over Dubai port operators and Iraq war woes, President Bush may be glad to get out of town this week, and he's getting way out of town to India and Pakistan. Half a world away, booming India is emerging as a new partner and a new challenge, as a nuclear armed power, as an economic power and destination for outsourced American jobs, as an ancient post-colonial nation with its own distinctive view of the world. For decades, the U.S. and India barely spoke. Now India needs America and its markets, and America needs India as a market, as a balance to rising China, as an example of democracy at work in the developing world. Up next on Point America, Bush and the meaning of booming India. Joining me first from Washington, D.C. is Jim Vandehei, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. He will be traveling to India with President Bush. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
I suppose one advantage is just getting out of town. It hasn't been fun lately. But what is the Bush administration hoping will come out of this state visit to India, Jim?
Well, I think it's twofold. I think first there's going to be the 3 days in India where, you know, President Bush clearly sees India as an ally and emerging as a much closer ally, both potentially militarily, but economically speaking right now. I mean, it's just such a huge country growing with an economy that's growing at a very fast rate, imports and exports going up tremendously between the two countries. And, Indians who've immigrated to the United States are playing an increasingly large role in all kinds of industries, in particular in Silicon Valley. So the president wants to go there to talk about this strategic relationship and really push for the nuclear proliferation deal that you were talking about, this idea of splitting the civilian and military nuclear programs in India in exchange for the United States for the first time giving India access to civilian nuclear assistance from us.
Washington was stunned in 1998 when India, out of the blue to the CIA and everyone else apparently, tested a nuclear weapon, joined the nuclear club. They've never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Right.
And as I understand, that's not on the table here either. So what exactly is the president proposing, and why is he prepared to cut India a special deal?
Well, I think it's sort of an acknowledgement of the reality that it's already a nuclear power and at least try to get some concessions where they split off the civilian and military programs in exchange for our assistance. Obviously, there's a lot of opposition to it, both internationally and here in the United States inside Congress. You've got Republicans and Democrats who raise the exact same point that you do, that they're not a signer of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is a treaty the United States promotes in dealing with other countries. So it's been a complicated deal, and the president had hoped to, you know, announce this in July, and had hoped to have some kind of deal to announce while he's in India, and it's looking increasingly unlikely that that's going to happen, both from opposition here and opposition there.
What's been the sticking point? Why can't they come to an agreement? That was supposed to be the jewel in the crown here.
Well, on our side, we have just a lot of opposition from Congress. There'd be a lot of laws that would actually need to be changed to be able to give civilian nuclear assistance to someone who's not signed the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. In Asia, there's been this sort of back and forth between their government and our government about sort of how much concessions they should have to make to the United States. And so far, you know, there's been a lot of rhetoric, but very little in terms of coming into a compromise before we head out.
So what is the strategic importance that the Bush administration, that Washington is seeing in India? I mean, is India willing to play this counterweight role to China? Has it been helpful in the Iraq war and in Afghanistan? What exactly can India do for the United States?
Well, I think in the short term, it's probably more an economic ally. I mean, just remember the size of India, over a billion people in a market that's growing astronomically. And it's a government that the Bush administration, you know, thinks privately is probably easier to deal with in the long run than the Chinese, and it would serve as a fantastic counterweight if the United States can continue to build closer relationships with India. At the same time, you know, we've been playing this very delicate dance with the Pakistani government in getting their assistance in fighting Al-Qaeda, and there's obviously been this long showdown between India and Pakistan over the Kashmir region, and so they need as much assistance as possible from India in keeping that situation from ever blowing up again.
A whirlwind visit to India, just 2 days there, and then just one in Pakistan. Can the U.S. play peacemaker here?
Yeah, I mean, the Pakistan visit is interesting. It basically one day, not even in there for the whole day, flying in, flying out. But the president, you know, considers Musharraf a close ally in the war on terror because of the assistance that, he's given in fighting al-Qaeda in that border region between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Obviously, there's a lot of people who have deep concerns about Musharraf and sort of how committed that country actually is, given that, you know, a lot of people believe bin Laden is still hiding out in the mountainous regions there, and whether they've done enough to crack down on the al-Qaeda operatives that are operating in that country. So it's a delicate balance, but the president feels that, you know, since day one, since right after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, that he gave an ultimatum to Musharraf to either be with us or against us, feels that he's been with us, wants to reward the country with at least a brief visit, but given the instability there, it's going to be a short fly-in and fly-out.
And short in India, too. No Taj Mahal for this president. Bill Clinton spent 5 days there. George Bush, just a couple. I guess that means no Taj Mahal for you either, Jim. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, unfortunately. And this is just the way the president travels. I mean, I think he's gotten a lot of criticism for this over the last 5 years. He's not a sightseer. He doesn't pop in and like Bill Clinton, like to spend time and sort of soak up all the wonderful things there are in different countries to see and to enjoy. He's a lot of these trips, you're literally in a country, you know, for a day if you're lucky. You know, he'll go to the Great Wall, for instance, when he was in China, and spend less than 30 minutes looking at it, and then it's on to another meeting. But that's the way he travels.
A flying visit.
We have to travel, and we're with him.
And you'll be with him. Jim VandeHei with The Washington Post. Thanks very much, Jim, for being with us.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Now we turn to New Delhi, India's capital. Scott Baldoff is South Asia correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Scott, thanks for being with us. Is New Delhi ready for the American president?
Oh, they're absolutely ready for him. There have been newspaper accounts of his schedule printed every day for the past week or so. Every single nuance of what he will probably eat and where he will go and who he will meet has been discussed endlessly. So there's definitely a lot of attention here about this particular visit.
He's going to, of course, meet with the Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh. He'll meet with the Congress President, Sonia Gandhi, the widow of Rajiv Gandhi. He'll spend a little time in Hyderabad in southern India, talking with captains of industry back in Delhi. What is India hoping will come out of this visit, Scott?
Well, I think, if anything, there is not a great deal of expectation of any one thing coming out of this. The big issue that they will be discussing, of course, you talked about it earlier, is the nuclear deal. And there is a great deal of concern, certainly within the nuclear establishment and within the military establishment, about whether or not India is going to feel pressure to give away the store. India, at this point, is very close to coming up with a brand new design for a fast breeder reactor. And they would like to continue that process. They don't want to give away their technical advantage as they see it.
And the technical, the military application of a fast breeder reactor?
Well, it's more actually energy that they're talking about. And they I'm not going to bore you with the details about thorium and uranium-232, but for God's sakes, this is something that is, again, very much discussed in the press here. And it is it's a concern because India, of course, has a growing appetite for power. It needs it from wherever it can get it and doesn't want to be reliant on French or German or U.S. designs, which they see as inferior. But again, what happens is, more than that, there is a concern that once again India will knuckle under on an issue of sovereignty. India these days sees itself as a growing power. Why should they back down? Why should they accept this sort of control from an outside body?
Does India want to be, is it politically popular there to discuss being a close ally of the United States, not just a trading partner, but a strategic ally? Is that a popular position in India?
It is very much a popular decision here. Both of the main groups here, the current government of Congress and the previous government, led by the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which come from completely different vantage points from the left and right, both agree that they see the future in a relationship with the United States, but under what terms? India sees itself as a growing superpower, so if they are going to be close to the United States, they don't want to be the junior partner. They want to be increasingly seen as equals.
And in brief, Scott, from Delhi, any anticipation that this nuclear deal might actually get signed on this visit, or is the president likely to come away empty-handed?
Well, it's interesting. There have been a lot of people damping down expectations. Nicholas Burns, who left yesterday, he's the Assistant Secretary of State, said that, look, there's still a lot of distance to be covered. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh in Parliament today said that there was no way they were going to give away safeguards on their indigenous fast breeder program. So if it does come through, it's going to be absolutely the 11th hour.
So big banquets, but not necessarily a deal. Scott Baldoff with the Christian Science Monitor in New Delhi, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Last Wednesday, President Bush spoke to the Asia Society in Washington about his upcoming trip to India and his hopes to forge a new relationship with the rising South Asian power.
We have an ambitious agenda with India. Our agenda is also practical. It builds on a relationship that has never been better. India is a global leader, as well as a good friend. And I look forward to working with Prime Minister Singh to address other difficult problems, such as HIV/AIDS, pandemic flu, and the challenge posed by Iran's nuclear ambitions. My trip will remind everybody about the strengthening of an important strategic partnership. We'll work together in practical ways to promote a hopeful future for citizens in both our nations.
President Bush speaking last week, nearly on the eve of his trip to India and, of course, Pakistan. We're going to hear some interesting voices in this hour. First, I want to welcome into our conversation from Indianapolis, Indiana, Sumit Ganguly. He is professor of Indian cultures and civilizations, professor of political science at Indiana University in Bloomington there. Professor Ganguly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So here we have two countries that for, what, nearly half a century barely spoke to one another. India closely aligned for a long time with the Soviet Union. Then in 1998, the surprise test of a nuclear weapon really rocked Washington back on its heels. What's your sense of the health of this relationship today?
I think, as the president himself put it, the relationship has never been better. The transformation really started under the second Clinton administration after the United States got over its peak over the nuclear tests and actually supported India when India was attacked by Pakistan in 1999 in a region called Kargil in the disputed state of Jammu and Kashmir. And since then, the relationship has steadily improved, and the Bush administration, to its credit, has contributed significantly to the improvement of relations with India.
Sumit Ganguly, who needs whom in this relationship?
Actually, both sides need each other very much for the reasons that you spelt out at the very beginning of this program. The United States is concerned about the phenomenal growth of Chinese military and economic power in Asia and China's willingness to throw its weight around Asia, and consequently would like a strategic hedge and sees India as such a potential strategic hedge. India, by the same token, which has a border dispute with China and feels somewhat uncomfortable about the dramatic growth of Chinese power, would not be entirely averse to having a more robust relationship with the United States, though there is some ambivalence in certain parts of the Indian foreign policy establishment about getting too close to the United States. But in addition to the China factor, there's a burgeoning economic relationship, not in pure volume, in terms of pure volume, but in terms of the kinds of investments that are going into India in the realm of biotechnology, in the realm of informatics. These are sort of cutting-edge technologies, and there is considerable collaboration between Indian and American firms in these new areas where new technologies are being incubated.
That sounds like it's good for India. Is it good for the United States, for Americans, for the U.S. economy?
There is little question that it's good for the United States, because India, after having abandoned its sort of namby-pamby socialism after 1991 when faced with a major financial and economic crisis, has steadily opened up its markets and just about a month ago allowed American and foreign retailers to open individual stores. The next step will be to allow American and European supermarket chains to start opening in India. There is considerable opposition from within the retail sector in India against that, but I think that opposition will be eventually overcome. And India represents a very substantial market. The estimates vary between 100 million people who constitute a middle class all the way up to 300 million. If one takes the more expansive view, that's more than the total population of the United States.
So
this is not a trivial market.
Not trivial. So maybe one day the U.S. will open Walmarts in India, but does that really offset shipping American jobs to India, shipping American now high-tech research, as you point out, to India? It seems like it might be a loss.
That's actually overstated. I do not mean to in any way dismiss the pain of particular communities that have seen jobs being outsourced to India. But our economic problems cannot be traced to outsourcing. They simply have to do with the fact that we have almost a $900 billion trade deficit. We are buying far more things from the rest of the world than we are selling to the rest of the world. And they have to do with other structural features of the American economy. Outsourcing is a very small component of our economic problems.
Sumit Ganguly, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Teresita Schaefer. She's director of the South Asian Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. From 89 to 92, she was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia. She was former U.S. Ambassador to India's southern neighbor, Sri Lanka. Teresita Schaefer, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We're talking here about, in part, the big strategic picture. We'll come to the nuclear weapons in a moment. But here's India. Many in the United States would like to see it as a counterweight to rising China. I'm reading here former U.S. Ambassador to India, Robert Blackwell, saying there is no way better to empty a drawing room in Delhi of Indian strategists than to start talking about this idea. Are Indians really interested in being that kind of ally, strategic ally with the United States in relationship to China and anything else?
I don't think India is interested in being the anti-China friend of the United States. And I actually don't think the United States wants to play that game either. But there's a more complicated version of the China connection that I think is true.
Okay.
If you look in the grand scheme of things, the rise of India and the rise of China are the two big stories in Asia at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, the United States has had a very strong presence and strong friendships to China's east, in East Asia, in the Western Pacific, and in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And India and that area were kind of the places in between. With China's dramatic economic rise, with its very important military power, clearly the United States needs to have a more broadly based network in Asia, and that's where the partnership with India comes in. I think the U.S. has, in fact, welcomed India's improving relations with China. After all, if the two big rising Asian powers are getting along, if they're doing a lot more business, which they are, then that's a factor for peace and stability in Asia, which surely is in U.S. interest. But saying that there's a relationship with the rise of China does not mean that there's any assumption that the U.S. wants or expects to stoke hostility.
What about the quality of this partnership then, Teresita Schaefer? If it's a new century, we've got new rising powers in the 20th century, the U.S. and Europe were joined at the hip. Can the U.S. look forward to anything like that kind of relationship with India? Is it culturally too distant? Is it physically too distant? Strategically, does it have a different agenda?
I think that you're not looking at the same kind of alliance relationship that we have in Europe. Indeed, I don't think the word alliance is the right one to use.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't use it, but it's been thrown around a lot. Because that suggests a series of commitments to military action that operate with some degree of automaticity. And I don't think that's what we're likely to have with India. What you have instead, it's already begun, and I fully expect this to continue to develop, is a set of national interests in India and in the United States that overlap. What's already become clear is that for both India and the United States, the security of the Indian Ocean, the security of the sea lanes of communication there, of the very large amounts of oil that transit there is very important to both. This became clear when India made what at the time was a path-breaking decision to help escort U.S. naval cargoes through the Straits of Malacca
over near
Malaysia,
Singapore,
in 2002. I think that there is also emerging a large amount of common ground when it comes to the broader question of Asian security. India is strengthening its relationships in Southeast Asia. It's very much strengthened its relationship with Japan. You've got other areas where U.S. and India have different perspectives, but both the quality and the breadth of our dialogue has improved so much in recent years that I'm optimistic that the number of areas where we see the world in similar terms is going to increase.
But it's not; it won't be automatic, as you say. Let's turn, if we
it
may...
It won't have an automatic military component, mm-hmm. even though there has been a marked increase in the stuff that our military organizations do together on a training basis.
What about this nuclear issue? President Bush has raised the roof over Iranian advances in nuclear weaponry, over North Korean. Here's India. They've never signed the non-proliferation agreement, and they've already tested. I mean, it's a fact. Now the president appears to look past that to say, well, okay, never mind. We'll share civilian nuclear technology with you. He's traveling, I guess, with some corporate bigwigs, Americans that just might do that. Is this a sellout of the non-proliferation vision, or how do you interpret it?
As you know, this proposed nuclear agreement has been controversial in both the United States and India.
Mm-hmm.
My perspective, no, it's not a sellout of the non-proliferation treaty, but it is a major change in policies that administrations from both American parties had done an enormous amount to build up, so it's not surprising that it's caused a lot of controversy. What the president basically has accepted that India is now and is going to continue to be a nuclear weapons owning power.
Mm.
I think effectively the Clinton administration had already done that, although they were less comfortable with the position than the Bush administration is. And what President Bush proposes to do, as you said, is go the next step and lay the groundwork with legal changes in the United States and changes in some international agreements that would make possible the sale of civilian or the provision of civilian nuclear cooperation to entities in India that were designated as civilian and placed under safeguards by the government of India. And the list of what is civilian and what is military has been the principal piece of the implementation puzzle that has been worked on ever since last July.
And just how open that's all going to be. Sumit Ganguly, how does India look at this? I mean, they clearly didn't much care about international attitudes when they went ahead and built the bomb in secret, tested it in 98, surprised everybody. Are they interested in a deal here? What does the bomb mean, and nuclear independence mean to India?
Let me backtrack a little bit. To begin with, it's important to underscore that India opposed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty even before it went into force in 1970.
Because it said, wait a minute, what about us?
Not so much that, because the Indian argument actually was quite principled. I mean, I think there were certainly political considerations and strategic considerations mm-hmm. at play. I don't mean to downplay those. But I think it was quite a principled argument, arguing that this is an inequitable treaty. It places limitations on people who do not possess nuclear weapons, but only exhorts the nuclear weapons states, the original nuclear weapons powers, to make good faith efforts towards disarmament.
So it's hard limits versus pretty please give up some of your weapons.
This is exactly right. And quite frankly, there have been no good faith efforts towards disarmament. In fact, we are now trying to develop a new generation of nuclear weapons, but that's another story. The point is that India did not violate anything when it tested nuclear weapons first in one nuclear weapon in 1974, faced an entire raft of sanctions in the wake of that, and then tested five more in 1998.
Well, it didn't violate anything only because it wasn't a signatory, but it certainly violated the spirit, which has tried to contain the spread of nuclear weapons. And now, you know, Pakistan's in the game and Iran and North Korea talking about it. I mean, doesn't India, whatever its view, doesn't it taking up the bomb mean that proliferation is more likely? Don't we see that already?
Not because of India. Iran and North Korea fall into a completely different category. These are states that signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and now are trying to willfully and knowingly violate its terms. And they consequently should be appropriately upbraided for trying to breach the terms of a treaty. They could, of course, invoke what is called the Supreme National Interest Clause and withdraw from the treaty. They haven't done that, but instead they're trying to torpedo the treaty in a clandestine fashion. And consequently, there is global opprobrium against these two states. India simply doesn't fall into that category.
Srimit Ganguly, I know we have to let you go in a second here. What's your vision of how India is going to evolve? What kind of big power, with what kind of priorities is this country going to be?
One of the first priorities, certainly of this government, is the alleviation of rural poverty. The previous government, I think, suffered grievously in the last election because of its. They had this campaign called India Shining. And yes, if you were in urban middle class India, things were indeed luminescent. But if you were in various parts of rural India, life was still quite harsh. And I think there was a perception that this government was sort of uncaring. And there were other factors that also played into it. Regional politics played a very important role and the choice of partners in the electoral competition. But I think one of the principal concerns of this regime is obviously the alleviation of rural poverty. Another long-term concern of India, as has been alluded to in the conversation today, is the question of energy. This administration, this regime in India, is extremely concerned about India's long-term energy security, because without energy security, India's rate of economic growth, which is extraordinarily high right now, it was 8.1% in the last quarter, simply cannot be sustained.
But let's look at that, if we may. India trying to get a pipeline built from Iran to India, across Pakistan, of all things, to secure that energy supply. So that there's an example. What kind of partner, what kind of power will India be vis-a-vis the U.S.? It's got very much its own priorities here. It's building, you know, energy lines into Iran. At the same time, the U.S. is having so much trouble with Iran.
Yes, it is trying to build this pipeline, but bear in mind that the pipeline remains completely fraught. Matters have not been settled by any means, and there are important differences amongst the Iranians, the Indians, and the Pakistanis. There are questions about the safety of the pipeline as it passes through an extraordinarily disturbed part of Pakistan, Balochistan. Mm. So it is hardly a done deal, so to speak.
Srimit Ganguly, very glad to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure entirely.
Srimit Ganguly at Indiana University, author of Conflict Unending, India-Pakistan Tension Since 1947. Srinivas is calling from Wayland, Massachusetts. Srinivas, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What I think is India is the largest democracy and U.S. is the oldest democracy. They are, really friends. And the media here I have seen is every time they hyphenate India with Pakistan, whereas Pakistan is the size of a state of India, one state. And at the same time, they live on the money that goes from $3 billion per year from U.S., India has been like a non-proliferator and fighting terrorism for the last 50 years.
So here's the India-Pakistan tension right here in your call. You're saying lean to India.
Yes, because that's a democratic country, whereas if you see the history of Pakistan, almost more than half of their independent movement, they were ruled by military dictators.
Srinivas, we've got it. Let me put it to Teresita Schaefer. How do you see the United States handling this balancing act, Ms. Schaefer? President Bush going to be in both countries, Pakistan less time.
I've got a couple of observations
yes,
to make.
Please.
First of all, Mr. Srinivas, I think you've got your numbers wrong. The aid agreement with Pakistan was $3 billion over 5 years, not in 1 year.
Mm.
But secondly, and much more importantly, I think the U.S. is actually doing pretty well
at separating its relationships from between India and Pakistan. The trouble is, the difficulty in doing that is when you speak to people in Pakistan and in India, they make the connection. I think in some sense that India has come to represent U.S. hopes for what Asia might become, for what its big relationships in Asia might become. And Pakistan represents the fears for the horrible things that could go wrong. The primary U.S. interest in Pakistan at the moment is in anti-terrorism objectives. Now, I would like to see the administration reorder its priorities a bit, but clearly under any reordering of priorities, that would be a very important one.
Hmm.
Whereas the primary interest in India is really something different. It's building a relationship for the future. Obviously, none of this is going to happen unless the India-Pakistan relationship can stay within some reasonable bounds, because if you have another military crisis between India and Pakistan, then all of a sudden all the air is going to get sucked out of this long-term relationship and people are going to focus on crisis management.
Srinivas, thanks for your call. I want to turn to New Delhi, India now. We are joined from New Delhi by Brahma Chalani. He's professor of strategic studies at the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi. Professor Chalani, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What is the Indian government hoping to get out of this visit from President Bush?
I think the Indian government would like the visit to cement the U.S.-Indian strategic partnership. There's a lot of talk about U.S. and India becoming global partners, but that partnership, that relationship, has to be given some concrete content. President Bush is coming to India finally after being in the White House for 5 long years, and the Indians are hoping that this visit will set the direction very clearly now.
For a long time, India seemed to see the United States as sort of the imperial heir to Great Britain, which was the colonial overlord there. A lot of resentment toward the United States, a lot of distance, more affinity with the Soviet Union. How does the Indian government see the U.S. now in those terms? There's still a lot of concern there of a former colony about not being imposed upon. Does the United States seem to India to represent a superpower threat in any way?
Well, India is a large democracy, and the democracy here is deep-rooted. The attitude of the people here has traditionally been pro-Western. In fact, last year there was a poll conducted by the Pew Global Attitudes Project, which revealed that more people in India have a positive view of the United States than in any other nation surveyed. And that that poll really surprised even many Indians, because we had not realized that in India we have such a vast number of people who have a positive view of the United States. Yes, we also have people in India who look at the United States very skeptically. And in fact, President Bush is going to be welcomed by some demonstrators in India. But then this is a large country, and we have different views in society.
And they will all be, one way or another, on display there, I guess. Teresita Schaefer, what about the balance in this relationship? For Americans, India is a long way away. For Indians, there seems to be, as Brahma Chalani is saying, a very sharp, clear focus and a rising sense of friendliness or admiration for the United States. Is there a symmetry in the way these people see one another?
You know, the United States has great difficulty having symmetry in its relationships, and the same thing, for that matter, is true of India. We're both big countries. And most of the other countries we deal with are a lot smaller than we are. In the case of the U.S. and India, there's a different kind of asymmetry. The U.S. is in spite of India's dramatic rise and great achievements, is still a more powerful country. And I think this is something that you can't help being aware of. The important thing, though, is that I think what you've got is a solid base of mutual interests on which to build the relationship. There are also important shared values, democracy, as Mr. Chalani mentioned. You know, historically, we've paid a lot of lip service to the common value of democracy. I happen to think it's real. But turning that into a basis for policy is actually not all that easy. But what encourages me is that besides the shared values, you have some much more concrete things that we both care about, the kinds of things that I mentioned earlier, security in the Indian Ocean, continuing the expansion of trade and investment that has benefited both countries, Asian security. We have some common ideas and some divergent ideas on global governance. But for the first time in a long time, I think you have this common base of interests on which we can build.
Brahmachalini, look west from India, if you would, for us a moment, at Afghanistan and Iraq and the U.S. military involvement. Iraq in particular, how does the Indian government see that? Are they supportive of the U.S. Efforts there? Would they like the U.S. out? What's their strategic view?
I think Indians in general are very concerned about the military quagmire in Iraq and also in Afghanistan, especially the one in Iraq, because the whole region is getting destabilized. U.S. Interests are suffering. In fact, the longer this mess continues, the more difficult it will be to fight transnational terrorism. Also, the Indians are concerned about the fact that U.S. policy has not been consistent. Take the case about promotion of democracy, which has been George W. Bush's rallying cry of his second term. He doesn't follow one standard at all. Just take his latest visit. He's coming to India, but he can't visit India without also visiting his pet dictator in Pakistan, General Pervez Musharraf. And the fact is that U.S. Support for dictators in Pakistan, especially the present one, has only aggravated things there. It has only spurred greater discontent and militancy in Pakistan, making it more difficult to hunt down Osama bin Laden and to fight international terrorism. And I think the Indians would certainly like the U.S. to find a way to get out of this quagmire in Afghanistan as well as in Iraq, because unless Iraq is stabilized and Afghanistan's future is made more certain, we really can't fight this battle against terrorism effectively.
There's a view from New Delhi, where those conflicts are much closer to the doorstep. Brahmachalini at the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi, thank you very much for being with us. Teresita Schaefer, we've just got a minute here. What about it? The war in Iraq and India, how do you see New Delhi looking out on this? You heard Professor Chalani saying this is a problem. India feels threatened by how the American intervention has evolved.
I mean, the war in Iraq has never been popular in India. You may recall that the Bush administration in, I think it was late 2003, asked India if they wanted to send a division of soldiers to assist in the post-war effort. And the Indian government, it was the previous government, thought about it for a while and then said no. And that was backed up by a unanimous resolution in Parliament. But I think in Afghanistan, the picture's a little more complicated, because in Afghanistan, you have to remember that the Taliban government, which was overthrown, was unremittingly hostile to India. And that the government took over was built around a group of people who had become very close to India. Mr. Karzai, in particular, and the whole Northern Alliance, were considered great friends of India and were looked on with huge suspicion in Pakistan.
And you had a sharp eye out there for stability in those areas. Teresita Schaefer at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.